Overhead Doors for its support of Focus 580. Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in Central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Orange Taxi, a new taxi company providing services to the U of I campus and the Champaign-Urbana area 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 367-8888.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour, we'll be talking with architecture critic Alistair Gordon about something that he says is a kind of a place that brings us face-to-face with both the advantages and the frustrations of modern life. Its history has been a recurrent cycle of both innovation and obsolescence. And the thing that we're talking about this morning is the airport. He's written a new book that looks at the history of airport design, which is entitled Naked Airport, A Cultural History of the World's Most Revolutionary Structure. It's published by Metropolitan Books. It shows how the airport has combined architecture and urbanism to change many things, including the way we think about time and distance and style. It also had a great impact on how cities are built and how we do business. If you're interested in reading that, you should head out to the bookstore or the library and you can look for the book. And of course, here this morning, we'd be very happy to have your questions and comments. Our number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just a bit more about our guest. Alistair Gordon is a contributing editor to House and Garden and Dwell magazines. He writes regularly for the New York Times. His articles have also been published in Architectural Digest, Condé Nast Traveler, Vanity Fair, Town and Country, The New York Observer. He's the author of several other books, including Weekend Utopia, Modern Living in the Hamptons. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Gordon, hello. Yeah. Thanks for talking with us today.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thanks. We appreciate you giving us some of your time. You begin the book with something of a personal experience, a personal memory, about going out when you were young to see someone off at the airport. And I believe this is the airport that is now Kennedy and was at the time Idlewild.
I think it was just in transition from Idlewild to Kennedy. I remember my father still called it Idlewild, but it had been renamed Kennedy because it was the year of the New York World's Fair, 64. And I was taking my cousin with my dad, who was flying back. My cousin was flying back to London, and we went to the World's Fair for a brief visit, and it seemed, you know, frankly, a little bit shabby, you know, compared to our expectations. And then we went over to Kennedy with all its fabulous new terminal structures, and that really seemed like the real thing. That was the future. And I just fell madly in love with the TWA terminal by Eero Saarinen and felt this was, you know, everything about the modern world that I loved and wanted to be a part of. And, you know, about 3 years later, I flew out of there myself and was sort of dismayed to see how dysfunctional it had become in only 3 or 4 years.
That's the sort of the point of the story, that in a rather short period of time, we went from the idea that or the feeling that you had that this was a magical space, right, to something that was dirty and grimy and sort of falling apart and no longer had that kind of feeling. And we're only, as you say, I think the first part of the story takes place in 1964, and the next was in 1970, or at least I think that's when you talk about going back to the flying TWA, right, which, of course, TWA doesn't even exist anymore. How is it that over that very short period of time, we could see such a change going from this idea that the airport was a magical kind of place and it expressed a lot of our feelings of optimism and the way we thought, right, about what the future was and all of that in such a short period of time, for that to that image to tarnish so much?
Well, that was sort of the idea of the book, because I, like everybody who, you know, who travels a lot, I'd had those sort of meltdown moments in airports and wondered, you know, how could it possibly get so bad? How could something that had, you know, this sort of utopian promise become such a nightmare. And usually we just turn it, you know, we face that in the modern world all the time, you know, whether it's on a highway or a shopping mall or, you know, in more drastic ways when we face terrorism or whatever. But to try to, you know, kind of deconstruct or analyze how the idea, you know, the utopian ideals of the modern world, of what aviation was going to bring us, versus the realities of keeping up with technology. And aviation keeps, you know, kept throwing this new technology at urban planners and designers and architects to try to meet that challenge. And it was, that's why there was sort of this constant process of innovation, but slipping almost immediately into a state of obsolescence. I think that's changed now. That's slowed down because we've had 740, you know, Boeing jumbo 747s since 1970 now. So that, you know, those changes did slow down for a while, but there was that period where I think the airport and aviation represented maybe as much as medicine, you know, the forefront of where the average citizen confronted the new world, you know, and the realities of new technology. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was, you know, it became sort of a metaphor for coming to terms with the difficulty of being a modern person in the modern world and not reacting, you know, our instinct is to just react against it and hate everything that was built after sort of 1920. But it's a very, very interesting place, the airport, because there is such an overlap of all these different things. You know, you have transportation, communication, architecture, urban planning, you know, now heavy surveillance and security issues. And it's kind of a fascinating laboratory for a cultural historian to look at.
Yeah, I think it, in a very real way. Again, one might ask the question, well, why would you focus on something like an airport? Mm-hmm. But I think that it is very true, and you demonstrate it all along, that the airport and airport design really is a reflection, maybe always has been a reflection, of what was going on in our society, both what our aspirations were and both what our fears were and are.
Right, that's absolutely true, and it's if you look at the early period when, you know, only very wealthy people and sort of movie stars and oil barons could afford to fly, it was like a theatrical event. Airports terminal design was really about creating a fantasy of, you know, a romance of flight, of what it was to fly, to be in the same space that people like Charles Lindbergh were inhabiting. And that worked fine in the 1920s up until the 30s. And then, of course, with the New Deal and the beginnings of the WPA program, where a lot of American airports were rebuilt, you had a much more sort of civic-minded public approach, and which really mirrored what was going on with the rebuilding of post offices and train stations and high schools. And again, it was pretty prosaic. Architects had a very difficult time imagining what this new form of transportation kind of demanded from them, and came up with very predictable solutions that looked, you know, that could just as easily have been a town hall or a high school or something. You know, very central entryways, kind of narrow corridors, and a frontal, centralized, ceremonial kind of sense of architecture that was comforting and familiar. Meanwhile, you know, out on the sides of these things, in fact, Midway is a good example in Chicago, you know, you have this very sort of classical, centralized form in the middle, and then you have these kind of gangly, odd-looking fingers and boarding docks sprouting all over the place. And in a sense, that's the true, you know, that's the true vocabulary of what this new form of architecture is about. And I make a point at some point about the second or third chapter, an American architecture critic named G.E. Kidder Smith took a trip through Europe sort of analyzing post-war European modernism and described this one airport, the new terminal at Gatwick in England. And he described its quality of airportness because it wasn't trying to be something other than what it was. It wasn't trying to be a train station or, you know, a temple or a city hall. And it was a very narrow glass and steel building. And that's the first sign I see of a critic kind of recognizing an inherent beauty in this thing that to most of us seemed ugly and kind of strange. And so there is the beginning of seeing, you know, Proust said something wonderful about 19th century train stations. He called them marvelous but tragic, you know, and he saw everything about the 19th century in terms of, you know, the Industrial Revolution, but also the shift in the sense of time and space and memory being altered by this new form of transportation, the railroad then. And I think it's very similar to now with the airport. You have this wonderful sense of the future, which we don't have much anymore, but, you know, the expectations up through the 60s was that we really would get to that point where, you know, all the stewardesses were beautiful and everybody could fly supersonic and be in Paris in 2 hours and the world would be wonderful. And, of course, something else came along.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to have you talk a little bit about the title of the book. Mm-hmm. This comes from one of the very big, very famous names in the history of architecture, Le Corbusier, yeah. who said this in the 1930s, that an airport should be naked. What right. did he mean by that?
Yeah, that's a good question. The name just sort of screamed out to be used. that expression screamed out to be used as the title of the book. It was actually in 1946, I think, he said it right after the war. He was speaking at a national aviation convention in Paris, and I guess Europe was starting to try to think how they were going to rebuild their cities and their airports. And he was asked to kind of give an overview, and he said, look, the beauty of an airport is in wide open spaces. You know, it's not about the architecture. It's about the airplane itself, you know, this wonderful kind of machine god sitting in the middle of the field. So don't have any other distractions. And he did these very, we don't know what he would have done if he'd designed an airport, but he did these very sketchy drawings of terminals that were actually underground with glass, some kind of glass ceiling, so that people would be in those terminals and looking up at these, at the airplanes on the field. Otherwise, you wouldn't see anything except for, you know, the tarmac and the airplane. So he said, after that, he said, you know, beauty of an airport is in wide open spaces, and airports should be naked. And that's what he meant, that it should just be the airplanes, but also that it shouldn't be trying to evoke something from the 19th century or something from, the pre-industrial revolution. It should be about what the thing itself was, which was the airplane and high-speed travel.
Well, given the fact that certainly over time some celebrated architects have looked at the airport and looked at it as a possibility to do something interesting and to create a building that says something, that it expresses perhaps some of our great aspirations, given the fact that what has happened over time to air travel is that it has become more of a method of mass transit. And now, even in as much as people complain about it being uncomfortable and that there's not much in the way of amenities anymore, what seems really to be important to people is that they want to get there as quickly as possible and they want to get there for the lowest fare as possible. So it's become something of the equivalent of riding the bus. You know, given the fact that that's what has happened to air travel and that's the way people think about it, should we really expect that an airport is going to be anything more than a big bus station?
No, that's a really good point. And you beginning really in the early 1970s with the coming of the jumbo jets, that's when that era began. And you can see it, really distinctly at places like JFK, also at O'Hare and LAX and San Francisco, where these really kind of lighter than air, almost whimsical 1960s jet age terminals suddenly get these enormous additions, and instead of having, a sexy cocktail lounge or a restaurant, kind of a 4-star restaurant on the top of the terminal, you get these mass food courts, with microwave food, and you get, just everything becomes, as you say, mass market and like cattle, kind of shifting cattle around. And that's most of our experience, most of our experiences is that side of it, unless we're much older and remember the 1930s. But there's something that came out, I think, starting really in the 1980s, where, to be competitive in the global airline market, you do need to sort of offer something special, and especially, in the 80s and early 90s in the Pacific Rim, you started to get, these fantastic airport expressions like Sir Norman Foster's new airport in Hong Kong, the new Singapore airport, Kuala Lumpur has a fantastic new airport. And there, that's where the airport is used as a lure for new kind of global capital. And I think that's brought back a lot of the sense of, and I think even, the United Terminal in Chicago is an example of that. When you're competing in a very busy hub, the individual airlines need to do something that's luring new passengers.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Alistair Gordon. He is an author, critic, curator, contributing editor to House and Garden and Dwell magazines, and has written for a number of other publications. He has a new book out, which is titled Naked Airport, A Cultural History of the World's Most Revolutionary Structure, and it's published by Metropolitan Books. If you're interested, you head out to the bookstore and look for it. Of course, questions, comments here are welcome, too. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. I'm interested in, you know, we've sort of sketched an overview here of going back and talking a little bit about early airport design, because one of the interesting things that you look at is the fact that people, particularly, I guess, here in the United States, which was a little bit behind Europe in the growth and development of the airline industry and also places for planes to take off and land and people to go and get on the plane, that when people got around to designing airports, they didn't really have much, they weren't really sure where to go. They didn't know what an airport was supposed to look like. And so they did indeed fall back on other kinds of structures that they knew and other kinds of people moving places like train stations, for example. I guess would have been a natural thing to do, to borrow from something else to try to build this new thing that was in some senses the same and yet, of course, in other ways different.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the best example of that is, and it makes so much sense in American culture, is Henry Ford, you know, saw this possibility of the airline and aviation as a new market for him and for his sort of Fordian system of, you know, mass production. So he was, you know, not only making airplanes like the Ford Trimotor, but he was building airports. And the first was in Dearborn, which I guess arguably is probably it might be the first comprehensively planned American airport. And it had a very simple, you know, almost temple-like structure as the passenger terminal, very well separated from the aviation works and the hangars, you know, which were noisy and dangerous and greasy and everything. So that was important. I mean, they recognized that passengers needed a sort of symbolic place that was separated from where the airplanes were repaired, which, you know, before it would be, you know, you'd kind of arrive in an airfield and sit around in a hangar waiting for the next plane, and if you were lucky, you'd sit on a mail bag in the back of the plane. And then slowly, you know, the big shift, of course, was Lindbergh's flight, you know, to Paris in 29, and then in 27, I'm sorry, and then after that, everything really changed, because there was suddenly this heroic figure flying all over the United States soon after his trip to Paris, promoting the building of new airports. So every municipality in America was sort of competing against each other to outdo the other city in the best and the brightest new airport. Now, of course, that was sort of came to a halt with the crash and the depression, but that got the system going and people kind of exploring what was this place, how was this place supposed to kind of symbolize, you know, a public space. There was a major design competition in 1929 sponsored by the Lehigh Concrete Company, and that most of the entries to that were very, very conventional Beaux-Arts, you know, buildings that looked like, some of them looked like palazzos, some of them looked like city halls. You had extremely avant-garde submission by Lloyd Wright, who was Frank Lloyd Wright's oldest son, that I think, you know, was the most interesting of the bunch, because it was this very peripheral building around a circular field, and he understood the notion that aviation demanded a completely new paradigm for what architecture could be. So it was this very narrow building, and the roof was raked at an angle that was equivalent to the angle of ascent of an airplane. So he had worked in an aviation factory when he was young and understood the nature of aviation. So you have all these kind of different architects playing around, not really being sure what it should be. And I found that to be, you know, kind of fascinating. You know, that part of it was denial, part of it was, you know, what do we do with this? How is this going to change our lives? And how, as architects, do we interpret that change?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and then maybe this is just in the nature of architecture, that partly it is an exploration of ideas,
right,
and that not necessarily intended to be something that you might not go out and build. But it does fascinate me that so many of these visionary architects had these odd things that you'd have to ask, as in the case of Wright's airfield that does not have conventional runways, or something like the designs of putting airports in the middle of enormous cities with blocks of skyscrapers, you'd have to say, now, from a practical point of view, would you really want to be flying a plane in there? Or how exactly does an airport without conventional runways work?
Right.
It doesn't really seem that they focused much on the practicalities of takeoff and landing.
Well, I think most of that was paper architecture. It was they never thought any of that would be built. I mean, Le Corbusier, when he was drawing his city for 3 million people, and that I think that's what you're referring
yes.
to. You know, he has this airfield. It's called the Central Air Station, and it was completely suicidal kind of airport because the pilots would have to fly down between these great glass skyscrapers into the central airfield. And, you know, Le Corbusier had never been up in an airplane when he drew that. And then, subsequently became an avid aviation buff and realized that that was absurd and that airports needed to be outside of the city central. But all those early utopian architects in the 20s and early 30s, they saw the airport as kind of a key to the new city, that it could somehow, if you had an airport at the center, like St. Elia, the famous, and short-lived futurist Italian architect, envisioned transforming Milan with this enormous kind of central station that would have trains running underground and then an airport on the roof. And there were, I would say there were hundreds of versions of that you see in the 1920s around the world. Again, it was visionary. It had no reality to it. But the people who are meanwhile actually building real airports were, it was pretty prosaic, simple affairs for not that many people who were flying. But that, of course, changed in the 1930s. It especially changed after World War II, when you had, thousands and thousands of GIs coming back who had flown all over the world, who were used to flying. Airlines were more competitive. There were more airfields that had been built during the war. And you had suddenly a new culture of mass air travel, which you'd never had before.
We have a couple of callers here, someone on a car phone, so we'll get right to them on our line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah, hi. I've been enjoying the program this morning quite a bit, bringing back a lot of memories. I'm 50 years old, and I grew up actually right next to Midway, and about 10, 15 years ago, I used to fly quite a bit as a consultant, and I remember coming into these airports, be it New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, and the ticket taker actually saying, well, you're early for your flight, but if you run through the terminal, you can catch an earlier flight. And I remember running, and my wife and I took a long vacation this summer with our kids, and there's no more running in airports. they make you take off your shoes, and it's as David said, it's a necessary evil nowadays, but it's kind of sad. You want to get there, you just want to get out of there as quickly as possible, much like a Greyhound bus with wings. So I have these fond memories. I also, too, what strikes me is these movies that came out in the early 60s with Tony Curtis and Cliff Robertson about the jets, and it's all very sexy and very romantic, and a lot of people at that point hadn't flown, so it was like a mysterious thing, and everyone was a movie star, and the stewardesses were wonderful, and of course that's all gone now. But I wanted to make those observations, and it was kind of too bad we lost that with the security thing, and now an airport is just a means to an end, I suppose. So anyway, I just wanted to make those comments.
Sure. Well, thanks for the comments. I don't know, Mr. Gordon, you want to react to any of that?
No, that's interesting. I think that's how a lot of people feel. Another reason I liked the title Naked Airport was something happened, as the caller was describing, when, this, of course, happened way before 9/11. In the early 60s, you started to have the first hijackings to Cuba, and this new sensibility, by 1970, you had architects were being hired. There are one or two firms I mentioned in the book who had specialized in designing maximum security prisons, and they were brought in to redesign some of these international, arrival terminals where they had to deal with the possibility of terror, especially in places like Miami, where you had. So this idea of, of the naked airport, of this great sense of transparency and open, sweeping space that you'd had in early airports, or at least in the jet age, suddenly becomes internalized, and all these wonderful glass pavilions are boarded over. this happened at Kennedy in the International Rivals Building. I remember, I think it was 1972. Suddenly that thing that was called that central atrium that was called the glass fishbowl was completely boarded over so that terrorists couldn't signal each other, hijackers couldn't signal each other. And then you got the first, I think, 70, I have it in my books, around the same year you had the first metal detectors coming in. So suddenly the sense of openness and transparency is transferred from the architecture to this, you know, this machinery that's actually scanning your body and scanning your bag, and it becomes a whole other kind of experience. But again, I think it's the first time most of us experience that kind of technology, whether you like it or not. It's horrible, to be sure, and it's depersonalizing. But again, it's the sort of frontier of what it is to be human in the modern world. And then we run back to our Victorian homes and try to forget about it. But it's very much there.
Yeah, I just, you know, and thinking, listening to the caller and thinking, reading the book, and you're talking about your experiences, it makes me think back to when I was a kid. I grew up in the Chicago area, and I remember having been taken to O'Hare Airport just to watch the planes take off and land.
Right.
This was a kind of entertainment, and you just cannot imagine anybody doing that now. Gee, let's go out to the airport and watch the planes take off.
Yeah, I remember being taken to see Kennedy, I think the very first year that the central area called Liberty Plaza opened, and it was all these dancing colored fountains that had been based on, I learned subsequently, of course, you know, it had been based on Versailles, which is a funny idea. But, you know, of course, they did away with that 5 years later for parking lots. But I have this extraordinary memory, same kind of memory of going and watching the planes take off and having a fancy dinner in the restaurant. And it was, of course, a wonderful.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with, we have another caller here in Belgium, which is a nearby community over near Danville. It's line number 4. Hello.
Yes, your conversation puts me in mind of many memories. As a very young lad, I lived at what's now called Baltimore Washington International. At that time, it was called Friendship International. And everybody would stand on top of the airport and watch the planes come and go. They had a very large observation area there. You could watch planes come and go, which they just don't do anymore, do they? You just don't even get hard to get to see your loved ones leave. But the point I was going to bring out is in the early 70s, I left from Indianapolis and flew to Atlanta. And Indianapolis was kind of a new airport and going bustling. And Atlanta, they were right in the verge of changing one of those real old airports, you know, the ones that had different buildings in different spots. And like you said, you ran from one building to the next to get to the airplanes. And we flew then to Puerto Rico. And the airport got just a little bit older. And our final destination was in Tortola in the British Virgin Islands, where it was nothing more than a grass hut. Which,
that's the best of all.
Yeah, and it was just such a great trip to see you went from one thing to another as it went along. I'm sure nowadays those things don't even exist in those kind of places. Obviously, it wasn't a jet that landed in the last place. It was, you know, a 4 or 5 person airplane, and it just made a magnificent ride to see the different things. Didn't really have much of a question, but just an observation.
It was interesting you mentioned the Atlanta airport. I think the one you're talking about is Atlanta was in the transition then from the old Hartsfield,
exactly,
60s terminal to this area called the Midfield Complex, which was, as far as I know, the first direct result of Jimmy Carter's deregulation of the airline business. So you had, for the first time, an airport, you know, this huge sort of rabbit warren of an airport being designed by the airlines themselves. So there was very little in the way of, you know, passenger amenities. It was all bottom line. It was all about hubbing and how do you get, you know, this plane load through the terminal to transfer to another plane. And of course, I think that was might have been the bottom of the barrel in terms of air travel.
Oh, it was hard. It was truly hard. Well, thank you very much, sir.
All right, thanks for the call. We'll go to somebody here in Indiana. I believe this is line number 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Couple questions and broad brushstrokes, I guess. If we still had the Flying Clippers, this thing about the architectural aspects of airports would probably be quite different, I would imagine. Secondly, at one time there was a more or less war going on between airline people, in a broad sense, and people who had power lines, throughout the United States. In fact, a whole series of movies have been made just on that part about, you know, the hero hitting the high wires and dying in flames and things like that. I was wondering if you could give some sketches on, in a sense, the more negative aspect, other than what you've already done about the airports, like taking away farmland, causing environmental problems and things like that. And I guess now we're at the place where we're almost become an icon, where we used to talk about the trains were never on time. Now it's, I guess, it's the airplanes are never on time. Thank you.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't. I wish I had gone into more of that issue in my book, because I think it's an incredibly important part of the story. It's very difficult to trace that. You know, that's almost like an entirely different book, but it's a fascinating subject, how airports have changed the environment in a very direct, impactful way, and there have been a lot of studies on that. I just mentioned sort of famous kind of benchmarks in, you know, with obviously the coming of the SST, the Concorde, these citizens groups getting together and mobilizing, and Ralph Nader got involved at one point in the mid-60s, and you have a kind of anti-airport... Really, by 67, 68, you have this kind of anti-airport movement that you'd never had before. And that was just coming out of the reality of that airports were expanding into residential neighborhoods. They didn't have any more room to expand, especially in older cities like Chicago, New York, and San Francisco. And, you know, airports tended to push out into the sea more and more, and then that was a whole other environmental disaster. And in the early 70s, you get a rash of, there are dozens of these plans, and they were seriously considered at the time to build enormous new supersonic airports well out in the ocean. You know, God knows what that would have done to environmental issues, but the story in a way almost comes to an end at that period, because there is, at least in the West, in Europe and in the United States, there's very little new kind of airport building from scratch. It becomes more about reconfiguring what you have, readjusting, and kind of in some cases even downsizing. One of the callers mentioned Friendship Airport in Baltimore, and that was when that was built after the war. They expected it to become this huge new hub that both Baltimore, Philadelphia, and Washington D.C. would use. And it was the one case where they'd overestimated, and the airport ended up being quite empty for years after. Through the 50s, through the Cold War period.
Hmm. Well, I'm not sure what's going on in other places, but certainly that is a story that continues today. We can see it here at O'Hare, mm-hmm. where in the last couple of years, where they've been talking about expanding the airport and building a couple of new runways, that met with a lot of opposition from people whose homes were standing on the place where they're talking about putting the runways,
right.
And where there's a lot of concern about what it is that gets torn down to make the runway, and also something that's probably a continuing, always has been, and maybe always will be a concern for people who live around the airport, and that is the noise that's generated by the planes taking off and landing.
There's a long history to that, too. There was a period where Newark Airport was shut down in 1956, because about four or five planes crashed into either Elizabeth, New Jersey, which is the residential area right near Newark Airport. And, you know, horrible scenes of disaster with whole neighborhoods burning down. And you had the first presidential commissions. I think Truman appointed a whole commission to look into that kind of, you know, safety radius around airports. But, of course, once you have an airport established in an urban zone and then residents encroach closer and closer to the airport, you're going to have that issue. Whoever comes first, it doesn't matter. It just becomes a very, very, you know, severe kind of political, economic, and environmental crisis.
We have another caller in Homer, line number two. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
One of the things you're bringing up, the airports and some of the old airports, I used to, when I was growing up as a early to mid-teenager, flew to visit family right in the era of People's Express and out of the old Newark terminal. And that was such an interesting airline, and you know, it was $27 you paid cash on the plane, 50 cents for a Coke. But it was such an interesting, it was a lot like a train station. And in this old airport terminal, and it was, well, it was a fun way to fly. It was, you were getting what you paid for. But it sort of was a difference from these nice new modern things with the really fancy jetways. But the thought I had on airports was how much more, I've got a family in Washington, D.C., and I'll fly international. Where I'll pay extra to do that because you can hop on the metro. And, I think Newark finally has added that so you can get connected to the railway. But that's one of those things that I'm wondering, how come more airports aren't connected to the regional metro public transportation system, with the exception that our public transportation systems are kind of antiquated and nobody puts any money into them?
That's a really good question, and it's where the development of European airports are so different than in North America, because you here, when the huge boom in the jet age of new airport building was happening, it was concurrent with the expansion of the highway system and the whole kind of car automotive mentality that was changing the entire American landscape. So you had JFK when, in New York, they could have easily made a connection, a direct link to not only the Long Island Railway line, but the New York City subway system, but they very consciously decided not to do that. And it was the entire airport, as was O'Hare, as was San Francisco and LAX, which were all pretty much around the same period, they were designed more for the car even than the airplane. So you had these sort of long looping highways coming in and these different decentralized terminals and enormous parking areas in the center. And that was that's in a way the cultural history of that entire period. And we're still hung over from that. We're still desperately trying to reconnect this infrastructure that was improperly disconnected to begin with. I mean, New York, it's every week in the newspaper there's another disaster of this, the new the monorail at Newark and the new rail link at Kennedy, and they're just getting going, but they're very very slow to connect.
Do you suspect that'll change with the security problem? Because you used to be able to, I mean, that's always now been the problem recently of getting to the airport just to drop somebody off.
Mm-hmm.
It's recently been just a traffic nightmare. And that, that's the wonderful thing about the metro. You step off it and walk 100 yards, and you're there.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And I took my family, I was in Holland this past summer and with three little kids, and, we arrive at Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam, and within, a five-minute walk, we're at the subway or the train, and we can go wherever we want. It was just fantastic. But that's the ideal, but we're not motivated by, either municipal or national sort of guidelines on how urban transportation should be linked up. It makes so much sense. It's crazy. But it's very hard to do it after the fact. If you have someone like Robert Moses laying out the city so it's divided up by a series of superhighways, it's very hard to redo that 30 years later. It's just almost impossible.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let me just mention again, we have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and our guest is Alistair Gordon. He's contributing editor to House and Garden and also Dwell magazines and has written regularly for other publications, The New York Times. His articles have appeared in Architectural Digest and Vanity Fair and Town and Country. He's the author of several books and a new one that covers the topic here we're discussing. It's titled Naked Airport, A Cultural History of the World's Most Revolutionary Structure, and it is published by Metropolitan Books. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And we have another caller in Urbana, line one.
Hi, I just wanted to add a little point to the discussion of why public transportation doesn't go to airports, because I just read recently that a lot of it had to do with the influence or the lobby of taxi companies and wanting to keep their monopoly on transportation out of airports. So I just read that recently, and I can't find the citation of which airports, but I have a feeling it's a lot of different airports that applies.
So, that's very interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, thanks for that. Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Again, other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Something that now people who may design and run airports really have to obviously have to address almost first and foremost is the security issue. So we know that perhaps people aren't feeling a little bit uncertain, although people continue to fly. I think we're getting close to the numbers that, that flew before September 11th. Right. I guess the one of the things I'm interested in, and this is another one of these ways in which the way people think about flying, the experience, the design of the airport has kind of come around in a circle, that back in the beginning, some of the people who were thinking about how it is they would design this environment were taking into account the fact that you could expect that maybe some good percentage of the people who were going to fly maybe had never flown before, or it was not just an everyday experience for them, and that they felt that it was important to make the space feel good, to make people feel relaxed, feel secure, because they were expecting that they might be a little bit uneasy about the whole thing.
Well, for good reason. In the early days, you know, you had a pretty good chance of not making it. I mean, there was this, I forget the numbers, but there was something like, I think, 1 in 100 passengers died up until about 1928, I think, if you took an American airline flight of over a certain amount of time. So there was a good reason to be nervous. And, yes, architects and planners looked to, first of all, architecture that was familiar, so something that looked like, you know, the local library or bank was reassuring, and I think this has come back today. I don't think, you know, we've had enough time since 9/11 to see an airport created that was directly a result of what happened then, you know, some, and I'm sure there will be somewhere maybe in the Far East or the Middle East, but instead you have this kind of retrofitting of, you know, narrower passageways to so people have to go through one single security checkpoint. And I haven't had it myself, but I've had friends who've had this iris scanning, you know, which is a whole kind of, you know, Orwellian, scary science fiction kind of technology where they instantly know your identity through your eye. But there was the beginning, I would say, in the mid-80s of the sensibility, especially in the global airports, in the Pacific Rim and in the Middle East. You had this sense of creating an oasis of calm and of greenery, and a lot of, like, the new Singapore airport and Kuala Lumpur, Denver is an example. You know, you have San Francisco is a very good example. The new terminal there has a big bamboo grove, and there, you know, there are waterfalls, and there's tinkling water, and there's this you know, a real effort is made to calm down the passenger before he or she gets on the plane. And I think that we're going to see more of that. You know, you're going to see some kind of completely new configuration that's based on the new security concerns, but combined with some kind of, you know, almost new age sense of keeping people happy and peaceful.
Let's talk with someone else. Mohammed, line number one right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very interesting show because just yesterday we returned from Israel and we were at the Ben-Gurion Airport, and we went there to visit the holy places of the Baha'i Faith in Haifa, Israel. And we flew in on October 22nd to the old terminal, and on November 3rd when we left, we flew out of the new terminal, which had just opened the day before. So the new terminal is just fantastic. We were there at 4:30 in the morning, so we didn't see much of the outside, but it's huge and beautiful, and the train now goes right to that terminal, and then it goes directly to Haifa. When we flew in, we had to take we took a bus. People took taxis, but we like to ride with the local people. So we took a bus, but we had to go to the center of Haifa and then take a taxi from there to our hotel. But that terminal is very impressive. Even their buses there, when you look at them, you can't see the tires. You know, there's just a new style. It seemed to be completely new. Do you know about that airport?
I've heard about it, yes, and I know that in Israel you really had the sort of some of the first airports designed for obvious reasons, you know, with security in mind. And I think a lot of planners took their cues from Ben-Gurion and other airports in Israel when, you know, the security issues became equal in other parts of the country. But obviously Israel sort of led the way in that. But I don't know that much specifically about that airport. That's another thing about doing this book. There are so many airports, and there's every single one of them, you could write a book about them, and they all go through changes constantly. And to keep up is almost impossible. So I was trying to really, you know, find key examples of you know, how architects dealt with, you know, urban situation or the human situation or the social kind of dimension, and just create a very human narrative about that, because it's a gnarly, you know, to put it mildly, it's a gnarly subject to kind of get a handle on and write as one individual. You know, what is everybody, you know, who's read this book or who I've talked to about it has a very personal story to tell, because we've all had, you know, nice experiences, but, you know, more often than not, we've had kind of nightmare experiences, and we want to share those. And it's, you know, it's not like I'd written a book about climbing Mount Everest, and not that many people have done that. This is something that everybody has done. So it's in that way, it's fascinating to me that everybody who's reviewed the book, too, has kind of made a point of beginning their reviews with their own worst experiences at the nightmare. So it's sort of something in a strange way that we all, you know, that brings us together as a community,
yeah, well,
you know, as a global community.
Yeah, I identified with it when I heard you this morning, because our experience was so recent. I did just want to say that we had a wonderful time in Israel, and people should not be afraid of going there.
Thank you very much.
All right, well, thank you for the call.
Bye-bye.
Others are certainly welcome. Again, maybe you've got about 3-4 minutes if somebody wants to call real quick. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Now it seems that there are at least some people who are thinking that at some time in the future, there will be a market for space travel, for commercial space travel, at least putting people into some kind of a vehicle that gets up into what technically is space for a short period of time. And it's been, we now have a private venture that's demonstrated that they could do it. And they're talking about selling tickets for people to take that kind of a ride. Now, it's not the kind of thing that everybody would be able to do or maybe would want to do, but I guess they think that there's enough of a market. Now, and I guess what I'm trying to connect this with the way people once felt about flying in an airplane, that it was a romantic adventure, and it was something that not everybody got the chance to do. And I guess I wonder if such a business gets going, is there a potential again for somebody to decide that the structures that those people depart from, again, it's an opportunity to make a statement, and some kind of a statement again about aspirations and their triumphing over fear.
It's a good question. I saw that footage like probably most people did, and I don't know if I'd want to take that ride. I mean, it looks like it was spinning like crazy. But, you know, it seems to me that might be almost like an extreme sport, you know, like bungee jumping or something. And that is interesting. I think that's part of aviation now, and you have these, you know, if you're a really avid skier, you have to be helicoptered in. And I know there are architects who work on these, you know, these new kind of ski resorts for very extreme skiing, and I'm sure there will be some kind of, you know, I don't know. I think the realities of aviation are pretty scary and mundane at the same time. You know, at one point they're boring, and the next minute they're terrifying, and I think that's more what it's about than the aspirational utopian kind of visions that we all love seeing in the, you know, in the 1930s, and then, you know, for a brief golden moment, seemed to come to realization maybe in the 1960s, or maybe that's just our fan. I mean, I was 10 years old, right? So that was my fantasy of the gorgeous stewardesses, you know, wearing red TWA uniforms. But I think it's you know, I had this moment about 2 years ago in Tokyo at the Narita Airport, and I thought, this has got to be the most modern moment I've had in the world. My father was dying in a hospital in Bangkok. My wife was about to give birth to twins back in New York, and I had to get back. And I, you know, I took one of these sort of middle of the night flights from Bangkok into Tokyo, and they had these, you know, little tubular hotel rooms, these tiny things that you could rent by the hour. Mm-hmm. And I found myself renting one of these things at 4 a.m. and, you know, went to sleep in this thing that had a a voice of a woman coming from behind a little print of Mount Fuji, and you know, they would give you a massage when you woke up, and there was this tiny little steam bath. And I thought, you know, it was sort of, this would be the terrifying future come to pass, but it was wonderful, you know, kind of womb-like moment, you know, in this very stressful situation. And I thought, this is interesting, you know, whatever it is, I don't know what it is, but it's the future. It's something to do with the future. And I think, you know, there's no way we can imagine what it is, and we're always going to fantasize something, and then it's going to come at us in a completely unexpected different way.
Yeah. Well, I think that it also that points out something that we really aren't conscious of, but what probably will guarantee there will always be work for architects and architecture critics, and that is there is this profound although sometimes very subtle relationship between the spaces that we inhabit and how we feel, that's always been true, and that's always going to be true.
Well, that's what makes architecture fascinating beyond, you know, specialized kind of scholarly pursuit, is that it you know, really, even more than art in a way, it reflects the state of humankind, you know, that it shows the utopian aspirations that we all you know strive for, but it has to deal with the realities of, you know, the economics and the politics of the day. And I think airports, in their way, you know, because they're such 20th century artifacts, you know, for lack of a better word, I think there's a lot to teach us. There's a lot we can learn about ourselves and our entire culture through thinking about these places that usually just irritate us, you know, and mm-hmm. we want to get through as quickly and safely as possible, but it's sort of sometimes looking us right in the face, you know, and we don't want to take the time to think about what it really means.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to stop, and I should apologize. I invited calls and suddenly got a bunch, and now we don't have time to take them. So my apologies to the people who are hanging on. If you're interested in reading more about the subject, look for this book that we have been talking about by our guest Alistair Gordon. It's titled Naked Airport, A Cultural History of the World's Most Revolutionary Structure, published by Metropolitan Books. Mr. Gordon, thank you very much for talking with us.
David, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Our show, Focus 580, made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. The show was also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. We're going to take a break. When we continue, we'll be shifting to a rather different topic. We'll talk about the need to focus on drinking water and sanitation around the world. Our guest Ambassador John McDonald, co-founder of the Institute for Multi-Track Diplomacy in Washington. First, though, we'll break. We'll have news from National Public Radio and an update on the market, so please stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
And with this update on the markets at 10:59, I'm Jay Pierce. Good morning. Well, as we take a look at the contracts on the Chicago Board.